Sadowski, and I work at the Smart Show. Today, I had the great pleasure to introduce both Rabbi Reese and Rabbi Zuckier to speak about contemporary topics in modern orthodoxy, a conversation on Torah, Neo-Hasidus, and technology. Rabbi Reese is the Av Basin of the Chicago Rabbinical Council. A noted Torah scholar, attorney, and jurist, Rabbi Reese continues to serve as Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz of Yeshiva University. Rabbi Reese is a summa cum laude, graduate of Yeshiva College, and received his law degree from Yale Law School, where he's senior editor of the Law Journal. He receives his rabbinic ordination from Reitz, where he earned the distinction of Yadin Yadin. His books, Kafa Yona, are available for purchase at the sale, and he'll be available for signing afterwards. Rabbi Shlomo Zuckier is a member of Yeshiva University's Kol Elyon and a PhD candidate in Judaic Studies at Yale University. A founding editor of the Lair House, he previously served as director of the OUJLIC at Yale University and is editor of Contemporary Users and Forms of Hasidut. Without further ado, please help me in welcoming Rabbi Reese and Rabbi Zuckier.
Thank you. Okay, thank you all for coming. We thought we'd have a bit of a discussion on some of these issues, which are all really current issues, contemporary issues facing, I think, Orthodoxy, not just modern Orthodoxy. I'm not sure how helpful that distinction is here. So I think we'll maybe take topic by topic, discuss, and we're happy to have some questions from the audience as well at the appropriate times. But I think we'll start with Torah. That was the order, and we're at the Sfarim sale. There's so many Sfarim here. So I have a couple of thoughts of different trends, and I wanted to hear what Rabbi Reese thought about them and see if he had other thoughts. One thing that, this is a longer term trend, not just the last few years, but America used to have, it was the home place of Rav Moshe Feinstein, had many shutim, had many halachic responsa, and Rav Henkin before him written in Hebrew. And with the exception of, well, I think the trend now, you don't find too many Sifrei Shutim in America, you still have them. In Israel, you find halacha sfarim that take topics and analyze them. Like, for example, Rabbi Reese's Kanfei Yona, to take different topics and analyze them, but not structured as analyzing 100 different issues in short. Really, more exhaustive treatments in essay form. And there's a lot of that writing is in English. There's very little halachic writing in Hebrew, at least from certain parts of the Orthodox world. At the same time, you have. We'll start with that. There are many other trends also, but I'm curious what Rabbi Reese's thoughts are as both a participant and an analyst in these areas.
I think that on one level, there has been a tremendous proliferation of Sfarim, of halakhic literature published both in Hebrew and in English. Both here in the United States and especially, particularly in Israel. But on another level, there has been, I think, a shift in terms of the emphasis of many of the Hebrew Sfarim that have been published, particularly, as Rav Shlomo pointed out, on this side of the ocean. I heard it commented recently that maybe we have shifted to a new era of rabbinic literature, that we know that we speak about the Rishonim and we speak about the Achronim. Some want to claim that maybe the last 100 years or so has been the era of the Rosh Yeshiva, but it's still an extension of basically what we know as the Achronim, later rabbinic authorities, people like Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Chaim Ozer and the Chassam Sofer are all understood as those that provided halakhic guidance and instruction for new types of questions, new types of situations that have arisen as the community structure in the Jewish life has changed, as new technologies have been introduced, as new sociological realities have been introduced. But that now, in the last, say, few decades, where we have transitioned to a new era of what we might call malachtin, rabbinic authorities who take basically everything who came before them and try to put it in some sort of an organized fashion, the same way that Rav Yosef Karo took all of the comments of the Rishonim who preceded him and made sense into Shulchan Aruch. So you have many, what you might call, if you were going to use a legalistic term, restatements of Jewish law. that are being compiled and gathered by all of the rabbinic scholars learning in the yeshivas of today, where they take all of the different bodies of shilos u'tshuvos, of responses that are out there, and present them in a streamlined fashion, telling you, well, with respect to this topic, this is what everybody, this is what everyone says. With respect to this topic, this is what everyone says. And this is happening not only in the field of halacha, but it's happening even in the field of lamdas. So you can find books nowadays that are not necessarily new introductions or new presentations of lamdas, that we don't have the definitive type of Shev Shmaitis, a lamda shasefer being published today, where people can do, or a Shari Yoshev, or Shimon Shkop, which is being published today. But you have works which say, okay, for the following topics, A through Z, these are the different breakdowns in terms of the analytical approach of the great masters of the past couple of hundred of years in terms of how they approached all of these different sugyas. So I think that we definitely do see that shift, and I would agree with Rosh Shlomo and with Rabbi Zuckier in that sense. But I would also mention, from my perspective, what I consider to be a more significant shift, just in terms of my own observation over the past 20 years of communal involvement in the Jewish community, and that is in terms of where the centrality of Torah and Torah instruction resides. When I started out in the Jewish communal world in the Beis Din of America over 20 years ago, we still felt at least the penumbra of the presence of Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and Rav Aaron Cutler, and the Satmar Rebbe, and all of the Gedolim who had lived in America, even if they were no longer around, we still felt their presence. They had only parted ways a few years earlier, and we felt like we were the major Makom Torah. If I had a Beis Din matter which involved the Rabbanut in Israel, the rabbinic authorities in Israel, I felt like it was my role, even though I was only maybe 30 years old at the time, I still felt like it was my place. I was riding on the shoulders of all of these gedolim to tell them what to do. That we're the ones who are the masters of the Torah, and we'll tell you how to do things correctly. We'll tell you what you need to do. And over the past 20 years, I've seen a seismic shift in that regard, where now the main center of rabbinic power, shall we say, in the world definitely resides in Israel in terms of Rov Minyan and Rov Binyan, in terms of the majority of the Torah that's being learned, and also in terms of the gravitas and the stature of the Torah scholars in Israel. They're the ones who are really defining the discussion, just like I think that we feel more than ever that the definition of who is a Jew depends much more on how it is defined by the rabbinic authorities in Israel than how it's defined by the rabbinic authorities in America. To me, that's the most significant shift. Not that we become insignificant, but yes, we become more insignificant. We have become much more dependent upon the approval and the imprimatur of the rabbinic world and the rabbinic authorities in Israel. I happen to think this is a good thing, because Kimitzion Teitzei Soed Var Hashem Yerushalayim, that the Torah is really supposed to come out of Israel and Yerushalayim. My solution is, if you can't beat them, join them. So I've tried as much as possible to become more part of the scene in Eretz Yisrael. I go every single year. I speak at the Dayanus Conference in Yerushalayim. I was just there a couple of weeks ago. But I think that we all have to take notice of this phenomenon and be part of the Torah world in Eretz Yisrael if we want to really make a meaningful impact even on the diaspora.
I think that theme of the shift to Eretz Yisrael is the centrality for many of these developments. I think we're going to see that not only in this area in Torah, but we'll see it in technology, some new technologies coming out of Eretz Yisrael, and also maybe especially in terms of Neo-Hasidus. So stay tuned for that. Before we go there, I wanted to linger a bit longer on English language Torah publications, or Torah and Jewish thought more broadly, and other media. So if you consider the nature of print media in the United States, let's say in Orthodox circles, so if you will go back 20 years, let's say, if that's our benchmark, the beginning of the millennium, you had coming from the YU and broader world, you had the Torah Ramada Journal, very active. You had the Orthodox Forum coming out essentially every year. You had Tradition running strong. And all of those were working within some sort of Torah Ramada paradigm. And 20 years later, there are some major shifts there. You find, the Torah Ramada Journal comes out every few years, but it has a lot less momentum. The Orthodox Forum, which we should have a volume coming out in a couple of months on Neo Hasidus, you'll hear about that more in a minute, but seems to be winding down. And Tradition has reinvented itself in a couple of different ways. It seems like there's a new trend, and this does start getting into technology. There's been a bit of a move of various publications online. So Tradition now runs a lot of content online. The Lair House, which I was involved in founding, is primarily online, as are other publications that are less Torah and Jewish thought-centric, that are more Jewish news. All the news publications have moved online. And I think you see that the trend here is a few different things. First of all, people have less of an appetite for reading full-length articles, which, is what it is. I think that's a broader trend in the American scene. People aren't reading long-form things. People aren't reading books. People want to read shorter things online. That's part of the trend. Makes you wonder, to what extent is it possible to convey sophistication in shorter amounts? People have said that Twitter and tweets are, don't lend themselves to critical thinking, although some people disagree and some people manage to have a very productive Twitter culture, including on what's called firm Twitter, as some of my friends call it. So there are major shifts. The shift is, shorter form writing, the move online, and I think that's shifted the sort of content that people are reading as well. And maybe this also heralds a move away from the Torah Umada integration view, which I think has been a hallmark of YU from the beginning. But I think you also see less of that, at least explicit integration going on. I think that comes along with this shift, although it's hard to correlate them in a one-to-one sort of way. I'm curious, Ray Reese, do you see similar developments? Do you have additional thoughts? And there's another piece to add to this in terms of the Haredi world and developments there.
In terms of the imprint Jewish law and Jewish thought publications that represented the contributions of the Torah Umada world, I think that we definitely have moved on from the previous model. There were a number of publications that people would eagerly anticipate and await receiving in the mail, but we just live a different type of life nowadays, where just like the print media is no longer as urgently needed as it was a number of decades ago, people live their lives on the computer and on their devices. So one of the main reasons, for example, that I was told by the editors of the Journal of Halakha and Contemporary Society, which is a journal that I contributed a number of articles towards, that Rav Schechter wrote a number of articles in, a number of members of our community. So one of the reasons why it closed shop basically a year ago, or a year and a half ago, was because they recognized that if they would close shop, at that point in time, nobody would even notice that they closed shop. So some of you are probably thinking to yourselves, oh yeah, that's true, I haven't seen that in a while. Because people weren't, paying such close attention to the printed publications, since if they wanted to see a halakhic discussion, they would just click on their computer the key halakhic words, and they would find five or six or seven articles or discussions online regarding the subject, bringing down all of the major sources, so that having it in the print media simply isn't as urgently needed as it was once before. Which raises the question in general, what is the value of having printed publications of this sort in general? To me, it does not indicate that there has been a lessening of interest in these types of halakhic or halshkafic discussions. I think that just the medium is changing, and we have to figure out how to adjust our message towards the new way in which people access and process information.
And I think I clearly agree. And I think if you look at the quote-unquote Haredi community, the community to the right of the YU world at large, there's some of that trend, but there also are some counter trends. So the publication Chakira, it's coming out of the Flatbush world. I think they're putting out a lot of material, and I think there's still excitement, at least in some circles, over that, dealing with a different set of issues, questions, at least in the early years, questions of Torah and science, issues that maybe had debates in the broader Haredi world that were of greater interest, and also more, some of their writing is in Hebrew, some more halachic issues that assumes a certain literacy that one can in that community. And there also are more, more other operations that other publications you might not have even heard of, small publications that happen in Lakewood or in Muncie that are meant for a certain subgroup, people who, within the Haredi world who are interested not just in reading classical Sfarim, but in reading things that are a little bit different, some history, some machshava, maybe even some academic approaches to various texts. You have this in Israel, and to a great degree you have it in somewhat of a burgeoning form in America. This doesn't, doesn't necessarily get out, but it's a very interesting trend that as there's a move away from long-form publication and reading in the quote-unquote modern Orthodox world, and you go to the right, and there seems to be more interest. It's almost like they are now, in certain ways, where the modern Orthodox community was a few decades ago, although with greater textual sophistication and greater, stronger backgrounds. You also see that in not only in Torah publications, but even in like the magazines, whereas things like, the Jewish Week or whatever is the Forward are getting weaker and are moving online. You look at Mishpacha and Ami magazine, and they're going very strong. There really is an interest in readership there. It makes you wonder what is it about the differences between the communities that leads to a stronger focus on print in the Haredi world and that success there versus really that weakening in the modern world. One possibility is, building on what Raris just said, is that there are fewer options, at least where you can't assume that everyone's online, so more things have to be in print. There's sort of a captive audience that has to be reading print, or has to at least say that they're folk primarily reading things in print rather than online, and that allows for a lot of different options and really the growth of some of these subcultures.
Right, and we, on the other hand, have witnessed the proliferation of Torah on sites such as YU Torah, mm-hmm. For example, where people just click and they can hear shiurim from a choice of, I think it's something like 300,000, shiurim that are online. That was unheard of years ago. But there are people not only in the modern Orthodox world, but in the Haredi world and, across the spectrum, who are listening to these shiurim, who are taking advantage of these resources. So if anything, I think that in the modern Orthodox world, at least the Torah that we're producing is getting out there, much more pervasively than it ever did before. And part of that is resulting in maybe the Torah Madaization a little bit of the Haredi world, because as the Haredi world becomes more familiarized with, say, the legitimacy and the authenticity of the Torah coming from YU, it also has become more legitimate, more kosher in their eyes. And in a way, the technology has resulted to some degree in the melding of at least the legitimate Torah communities. And I think that you see that even if you go over to the other side of the aisle, to the printed press in the Haredi community that Shlomo was referring to, such as the Chakira Journal, which admittedly is not necessarily, the most fully Haredi. It's perhaps what you might call Brooklyn Haredi, cosmopolitan Haredi. But nonetheless, you see many of the authors, many of the subject matters, many of the themes that are discussed are really presented in a fashion which is very compatible with a Torah Marta journal worldview, for example. So that I think that all of the technology, in a way, has bridged the worlds and brought us closer together.
On the theme of access, accessibility and YU Torah, maybe that makes some sense to shift to talk about technology for the next few minutes. So, I think there's a few different things that technology has afforded us, that really new developments on account of technology. I would say maybe I'd say four different things, but we can talk about each of them independently. One is access, which was just mentioned. Another one is new technologies and new methods that come about because of the technology, new ways of learning, new ways of producing texts. There's the question of education, and there's the question of various changes to human nature, changes to our interest. So just so we start with access, as we said, that YU Torah is the leader for putting Shiurim online, and many people listen to Shiurim. There's also another market, which is also similarly audio media, but is really a different market, which is the market for podcasts, where it's pretty open. There aren't that many podcasts on Torah-related topics. You're starting to see a few. I mean, the most prominent one is David Lichtenstein's Headlines podcast, which is not only you can also call in for if you don't believe in the internet, but it's been very successful over the last few years. And there's a few small ones in other Orthodox circles, but whereas in the general, let's say, American culture, there are very successful podcasts, you're only seeing the beginnings of it. So that's an interesting question of the access that the podcast technology allows us. How will that lead to new forms of content? And in terms of textual access, so for many years there's been the Bar Ilan Responsive Project, having a lot of Torah at your fingertips, which with at least a decent search function. But the last few years we also have Safaria, which puts those texts online. You don't need to have Bar Ilan, and there may be more texts that are made accessible and more more of an open source type of way. There's also wiki text in Hebrew, which has many sources. There's Hebrew books, which gives you access to the Sfarim, although it's sometimes harder to get to the text and hard to search. The OCR isn't great. But there's really been a revolution in terms of access. You could sit in your room with no Sfarim and have access to probably tens of thousands of Sfarim, anything you could possibly want, except for the handful of things that you can't get your hands on, which usually is what you want at the moment. So there's been a real revolution in access. I think the jury's still out on what impact that has. I know some people talk about this in terms of psak. You have more sources. What does that do to the psak? Or in terms of maybe what Reis mentioned before about the melachtim, about the gathering sources and reproducing them. The fact that there's access to more sources means that this is an open trend. So I don't know, thoughts on that?
And you still have to be a Talmud Chacham. You still have to have the training of a good Rebbe Muvak, of people who give you a derech halimud, who can coach you as to how to distill the sources, how to be able to differentiate which sources are the more controlling ones from which sources are interesting as a matter of trivia, but less controlling and less contributory to the discussion. And that's a special skill that not everybody has. One of the laments of a number of poskim and real rabbinic authorities of this generation is that we've reached a new stage of Ish Kol Yoshev Be'Einav Yaseh, of everybody thinking that they can paskin a shiloh, that because of the fact that they have this access, they could just look things up and figure out for themselves, because they find some esoteric sefer from 300 years ago that maybe was written by a communal rav who was a proper authority for his immediate congregation, but wasn't really viewed as a major halachic authority by the rest of Klal Yisrael, and relying upon things that may have been written on a whim or as a havamino or by somebody who just wasn't an eminent authority. So therefore, there's a real danger, at the same time that it becomes easier for a posek to access lots of different sources and to find things more easily, it also creates the trend and phenomenon that people are less likely to bring their shilos to those who are most qualified and most trained to paskin, and to think that they can really do it on their own. And it also becomes easier to found newfangled learning institutions and yeshivas, and for people to just start giving their own smichas based on their greater access to various materials without these individuals really being part of the Mesorah, really being part of the legitimate chain of transmission, going back from generation to generation to all of the great Rosh Yeshiva and the great Poskim, who very carefully transmitted to their students the proper way of explaining a sugya, the proper way of deciphering a shaila, the proper way of paskening a difficult question, the proper way of confronting the new challenges that are part of our lives. And therefore, everything in technology ends up being a double-edged sword, that there's good that can be done from it in terms of there being an easier route towards mastering and acquiring Torah, but there's also a downside if people, you know, don't follow our age-old tested methodologies for how wisdom is supposed to be transmitted from Rebbe to Talmud, from generation to generation, to a clearly defined and delineated Mesorah. That's why here at YU, for example, when we were confronted with, you know, Talmidim who wanted to just kind of do all of Smicha online and take the Bechinos, that wasn't something that we were comfortable with from an administrative perspective, because we felt that a large part of giving Smicha, a large part of having, say, a YU Smicha, is having the interaction with a YU Rosh Yeshiva, of sitting in shir, of being in the base medrash with the other Talmidim, of being engaged in the Shakla Vitaria of Torah, just like the Gemara speaks about that if you, Rayu Einecha Ro'osis Marecha, you need to be able to see your Rebbe, see the way in which your Rebbe deciphers the text, distills the different sources, the way in which a Rebbe conveys to the Talmud a proper derech, a proper method and approach towards figuring out how to be a sukei shmaitasa, liba dehilchasa, how to decipher the halacha from the sugya that's being learned. So there's an advantage in that sense in terms of the ability to focus on a very specific text, on being able to focus on very specific messages and teachings that are coming from a particular Rebbe, as opposed to becoming lost in the vast Yama Talmud, in this vast sea and ocean of different sources, without a clear guide, without a clear mentor. So, you know, it's interesting that there's a comment by the Maharal. The Maharal, in his commentary to the Agados, in Maseches Pesachim, so he speaks about the Gemara there in Daf Nun Daled that says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave an inspiration to Adam Arishon that he should take a donkey and a horse and breed them together so that he can produce a mule. Because otherwise there wouldn't have been mules in creation, because the mules themselves don't reproduce. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't create the animals that couldn't reproduce themselves, so he didn't create the mules. This was a human contribution. Hashem created the world in such a way that it could be developed further by human beings. So the Maharal asks the question, he says, but wait a second, this is a maisa iser. This is actually a forbidden act. According to Torah law, you're not allowed to engage in the interbreeding of different animal species. So how could that be something that was left for human beings to do in order to further the creation of the world that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had given us? So he says that there's Derech HaTorah, that there's a way in which a person is supposed to live their lives according to the Torah, and that's a special gift that was ultimately given to the Jewish people. But there's also Derech HaOlam. There's also the efflorescence of the world, the ability to cause the world to develop and to flower and to reach its fullest technological potential. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the capacity in the hands of human beings to create things, even though some of those things might not always be in the spirit of the Torah in terms of how they are utilized. And therefore, it's our job to see to it that when the world is fully developed through new technologies and the like, that we take those new technologies, which have a positive and productive purpose in terms of the Derech HaOlam, in terms of the Shleimus of the Bria, the completion of the creation, and we incorporate them into our Torah lives in a way which is consistent with Torah values and Torah priorities.
That's very interesting, the question of trying to educate remotely and using technology without that personal interaction. I think that you know, the limitations there are true not only on the level of smicha, but also more broadly in, you know, primary and secondary education. The last 5-10 years, a bunch of schools have tried integrating technology in various ways, but I don't think there's been, at least haven't heard of, a major success. As far as I can tell, you know, schools integrated a little bit here, a little bit there, but you don't have what you have, say, with Khan Academy, where you can essentially study, you know, math and science and complete an entire equivalent undergraduate degree all online. They have problems and they have lectures. That doesn't exist, as you know, as far as I can tell, hasn't existed within Torah education, which is really a necessary thing. You have people who live somewhere where they don't have access to a school. You'd want to have online schools that work on a high level. And makes you wonder how much of what's missing is the personal interaction with a Rebbe or a teacher of Torah. How much of it is just that some types of content aren't really transmitted virtually as well. Somehow the personal element, not from a Masorah perspective per se, but just in terms of being able to convey the information, may not work as well. Because, you know, just looking at the parallel in general education, Khan Academy has done very well in math and science, but not so well in the humanities, right? So, I mean, I guess you compare different parts of Torah to different sorts of things, but at least there are parts of the content that it's hard to formalize and put on paper and or put on a screen as the one approach. There may need to be more of a human touch, and maybe that's part of why that hasn't been as successful. In addition to questions of access and education, there's also some new technology allows for some new methods, some new abilities within working with Torah texts. I'll just mention a couple of, you know, very, very cutting edge things that some people are working on. First of all, for those there was a recent article actually in the Lehrer House by Avi Schmidman and Moshe Kopel who work at Dikta, which is in Israel, a technology and Torah. Torah Text Institute, and they have different programs that allow you to take a text and vocalize it immediately. You know, give it the nekudos. Where for some people, you know, you come across a text on Bar Ilan or wherever, and you have a hard time reading it. This would allow more accessibility. Also, they have programs that allow you to find parallel materials. You know, to sort of improve on the search capabilities of Bar Ilan, where you have to use specific words and, you know, you have to be very precise, and otherwise you miss a lot of things. But to use big data, some developments in technology to allow for finding parallels, and even some prospects of text recognition. So you have some texts, we don't know who wrote them. You know, this tshuva was written by we don't know who, or shita lo no dalami. And there are methods of identifying based on just the way people write, relative clauses, what sort of language they use. What is whether this chapter, this parak, is very similar in writing to this parak, and sometimes you can identify authors. Some very interesting technologies. Another group called Hamapa, the map, is working on mapping out tshuvos. Who is writing tshuvos from where to where? Are there any trends? Can we identify, also using big data, thinking about, you know, if you can get all these different data points into a computer and try to figure out if there are any interesting trends that one can determine. And one final thing, Hachi Garcinan is also an Israeli, part of the Friedberg Project, but basically an Israeli-run organization that deals with manuscripts. And they deal with Geniza manuscripts, but Hachi Garcinan specifically, in terms of the Gemara, Bavli, if you want to look at all the different manuscripts and see if anything is different, you don't need to like peer, you know, poke through all the Rishonim and see what they say and look at that Svarim that note these things. You can just, in 30 seconds, you can get for the daf all the different textual variants. For some people, this is more of interest than for others. These various things. Some have more need for this or not, but these are all very interesting new directions that will allow either access or more milaktim, right? Easier organization of the sources, and just more information packaged in an interesting way. So those are some interesting trends. Leaving aside all the trends that are not quite in technology, although they build on it, like the improvement of the various new sfarim, the Masifta Gemaras, the Oz V'Hadar, Frankel, Rambams, etc., all of these new developments, many of which are drawing on technology.
I heard a comment from Rav Schachter that he said that, you know, nowadays the way that you could tell if somebody's a true Talmud Chacham is if you ask them a shaila on Shabbos. They're not able to access any of these technologies. They're still able to know the answer. So that I think is becoming certainly true as well. But speaking for myself, you know, I find that it just is a tremendous time saver to have access to the Bar Ilan CD-ROM, to have the access to Hebrew books, to have access to Otzer HaChokhma. In a way, it creates, you know, more of a responsibility for us that we don't have an excuse to take longer to compile information that we need in order to answer questions, in order to be able to consider different types of conundrums that face our community, there's an expectation that while in the days of old, if you submitted a shaila to a posek and the posek didn't get back to you for 2 months, so that was considered to be acceptable. The letter had to go in the mail, it had to be received, you had to send a letter back in the mail, and there wasn't such an easy access. But now you get a text message at 9 o'clock at night, the people expect an answer by 10:30 at night. And it used to be that a posek would be able to respond saying, you know, I'm out on vacation, you know, with my family, and I don't have access to Sfarim. So now you can't come up with that excuse anymore that you don't have access to Sfarim, because all you have to do is go on your device or turn on your computer, and you have access to all of the Sfarim in the world. One trend that I have noticed that others have pointed out to me as well, in what you might call the Haredi world, is that the poskim are answering questions more and more, not in reliance upon the citation of different Sfarim, precisely because of some of the concerns and considerations that have been mentioned, that a person can say, well, that's nice, I found two other Sfarim that say other things, and therefore I'm not going to listen to you. What the poskim do more and more nowadays, and this, I suppose, is to underscore a point to their communities that it's not only about the ability to access the Sfarim and to figure out how to read the Sfarim and so forth, for which there are so many more study aids nowadays, but that they will say, well, when I was studying with Rav Moshe Feinstein, I saw him do such and such. When I was in the yeshiva with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, so he said such and such. That there's much more of perhaps a retreat to the mimetic tradition that famously several decades ago, Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik had said that we had moved away from the rupture and reconstruction. And now everyone is, you know, reconstructing, you know, what they're really supposed to do based on a more text-based tradition. So many of the poskim are actually going back in the opposite direction, where they're saying, that's nice that you looked at all the Sfarim that I looked at, but I was with Rav Moshe when he paskid the Shaila, this is what he said.
Wow. Really fascinating. The democratization of text culture, as you're saying, leads to a reversion to a focus on mimetic tradition. Fascinating. Maybe we'll end the section on technology with a talk of discussing some of the challenges and changes in human behavior that come about as a result, which will lead us, at least in some ways, into some of the changes that appear in Neo-Hasidus. So this is anecdotal. There aren't any really good studies of this in the Jewish community, but you know, I've heard people toss around the idea that now in the last 5-10 years, as people spend more and more time online and on social media, let's say high school students, the level of learning, the ability to focus has gone down. This may or may not be true. It's anecdotal, and I've heard it from a few places. But and they attribute that to the use of social media, and people don't have a focus. People are always jumping around between different things. You can't put your head in a book because your head's always focused on a screen. And of course, there are discussions of this in broader discussions in the New York Times and American culture more broadly. And some of the pushback to that is, well, you know, maybe people are spending less time in the books, but they have the ability to draw connections or to work more efficiently. There are other things that make up for it, or maybe they just deny there being any changes. So that's one possible trend that's been going on, and maybe relating to that, but going beyond study habits to more religious trends is in terms of the year in Israel, the Shana Ba'aretz, which has become mainstream over the past almost a half century now. It's become the sort of thing, if you go to a modern Orthodox high school, the expectation is you go to Israel for a year or two. And the argument is that for a while that had been an immersive experience. You go to Israel, you're cut off from your family in terms of direct contact. Maybe you talk to them once in a while. You're cut off from American culture. You're cut off even from your friends who are learning in different yeshivas. You're fully immersed in the yeshiva or seminary that you're in. And the argument has been that in the last 10 years or so, that no longer is the case. It's no longer an immersive experience that can really lead to personal transformation. Why? Because people are still in touch with their families, talk to their families every day. So they're really very much tethered, some people at least. People are in touch with their friends from high school. So it's not like you have a new peer group necessarily. You sort of keep your old peer group to a certain degree. And people are on social media or just consuming American culture from Israel. So even though you're geographically located in Israel, technology allows you to never really leave and to not be afforded the possibility of that immersive experience. And we'll talk about this more in a minute, but some have said that some of those trends feed into some of the trends in Neo-Hasidus. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Reisa, I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that, anecdotal or otherwise.
It's really difficult to say. I mean, I remember when I was a student in Eretz Yisrael, if I spoke with my parents on the phone once every 2 months, that was a lot. It definitely was much more a feeling of separation and seclusion. And I think in those days, you probably had a lot more hasmada. We were a little bit more connected, I suppose, to European times. We didn't even pay attention. If the Beis Medrash, when it was really hot during the late spring or summer, wasn't air-conditioned, and you had saksanim, you had these bugs falling from the ceiling, going into our clothing, and we learned anyway that there was a higher degree of fortitude, of zitzfleisch, of perseverance in terms of our ability to really just concentrate on the learning and to be transformed in that fashion. On the other hand, there's been more of a trend, I think, as the years have gone by, for students to spend even more time than we did in Eretz Yisrael. In my day, most of the students only stayed for 1 year, and a minority stayed for 2 years or more. And now I would say that probably a majority of students are staying for multiple years in terms of their studying in Eretz Yisrael. At least it's a much higher percentage than it was in my day. And they really are very much looking for the spiritual growth. The fact that they're able to be in touch with their parents more, that they're able to be in touch with their friends from America on a more regular basis, I don't know that it necessarily needs to be a negative. It's, again, just a question of utilizing technology in the most possible, the most positive possible way. And a lot really depends on the controls that are put into place in any given yeshiva institution in terms of the time, place, and manner of the use of technology. I don't think that in my mind that there has really been a regression in terms of what the year or the time in Israel has meant for the various students. I think that there's been a regression in general in society, that we had a movement at a certain point in time that people looked at their parents' generation and they hadn't been so super duper observant for a period of time, that they had been very comfortable with a greater sense of modernity, of engagement with secular culture. In my generation, there was a movement away from that where, like any children, they want to not be like their parents. So the parents are modern, so they decide we're going to be less modern. We're going to be more engaged in Torah study. We're going to be more engaged in Torah growth. And we had a very healthy spurt for a couple of decades in that direction, and now there's something of a market correction, I suppose you can call it, where the parents have really firmed out and the children are saying, well, we're not sure that we would necessarily want to be quite as right-wing as you are, and maybe we want to temper things a little bit. So I think, you know, it's important to, you know, view things in that general societal light, but I don't necessarily think that the availability of technology itself would be responsible for that trend.
So moving from the question of, I think, Rariz, what you alluded to, the decrease in zitzvleish, in ability to sit and just study Talmud. So some have argued that this is at least partially responsible for the move to neo-Hasidus. Just to quickly define that term, neo-Hasidus being the use and study and taking on a lifestyle to a certain degree of various Hasidic themes and aspects by people who are not from Hasidic communities, for example, from the YU Modern Orthodox community, for example. And so some have argued, I'll be quoting a little bit from a couple of forthcoming articles in the volume, which is titled Contemporary Uses and Forms of Hasidut, 15 or so articles talking about some of these trends that should be coming out in the next month or two. So one article by Rabbi Yehuda Turetsky, who's a Ram et Shalvim, so he, among other things, he frames some of the terms of Hasidus for people who don't find as much meaning, can't connect in the same way to Gemara. So a lot of them still while studying Gemara intensely, and some of them while leaving that on the side, they'll use Hasidus as an attempt to reach God, to reach Hashem, instead of focusing as much on the Gemara. Or even if they study Gemara, they're looking for the Pnimius. They don't want to get a Hakira and a Lamdus and an analytic focus. They want to find meaning and something that's relevant to themselves, to their own lives and to their own relationship with Hashem, and as a way of maintaining religious passion as a result. He actually points to three different types of people who are affected by neo-Hasidus, at least in the year in Israel, and as that goes beyond. Some really go all in. He said it's a very small number every year, a handful, maybe a half dozen people every year, who really, they take on outer appearances, in such as a gartel and payas and a beard, and they may learn a lot less Gemara and really just focus on Hasidus. They may have a hard time fitting in academic settings, so they want that spiritual connection more. That's one group. A second group more or less stays along the same trajectory they had been along, but they incorporate Hasidus in smaller doses. They learn some Hasidus on the Parsha. They find that as part of they'll participate in happy minyanim or the like, but that's not their central avenue of Avodas Hashem. It's maybe one part of it. And then he also points to a third group where parts of what they'll do, they'll go to Tishes, or they'll know a little bit of Hasidus here and there, but it's less definitional. But the really different groups, different approaches. But I think all of them, in some ways, the Hasidus is a way of supplementing what had been previously in place, which was maybe Rariz can speak to this better. Maybe in some yeshivas it's more intense than others. But you go to yeshiva and you. You learn Gemara and Halacha, and maybe there's a little bit of Hashkafa, and that's it. And that sort of is the old model that's been replaced by more spirituality and more Hasidus, and both Hasidus Torahs and Hasidus Hanhagas in various ways, I think on a small scale primarily, as a way of, and maybe that's part of counteracting some of the frustration people have with Gemara, or the you can't really be in it as much. Maybe part of that is what leads to searching for additional avenues, including Hasidus.
Yeah, I remember when I was going around the different yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael when I served as the menayel of the yeshiva here. So Rav Aaron Bina, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of Netiv Aryeh, he turned to me and he said, the Litvox have lost the war. There had to be sort of an acknowledgement over the fact that times have changed and students are looking for more spirituality than simply sitting by their shtenders and studying Shita Mekubetzit all day and all night, that we had to recognize that the students needed more. there was a certain amount of ruach. They needed the singing, they needed the dancing, they needed the farbrengens, they needed this dose of, call it chassidus, call it spirituality, call it psychological support, they needed this boost of emotional fervor in order to make their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu more meaningful. Now, as a seasoned, litvak or, trained, yeshiva bachur in the litvashi yeshivas from when I was a young child to the present, I don't claim to fully understand it or identify with it. If somebody says there's, a kalbach minyan, going on, so I run for my life, it's just my natural reaction. But most people, don't run for their lives. They might run towards the minyan, for their spiritual lives because they feel that it injects them with a dose of much-needed religious fervor and energy. And from my perspective, it's all good. It's all good. None of this is usher from the Torah. We speak about the place of davening as a makom rino tefillah, makom rino shamiyei tefillah, the place where you have singing, that's where you're supposed to daven, that there is sort of an assumption that davening is not supposed to be so much by rote. It's not so much as supposed to be a dry intellectual experience. There's supposed to be rina. There's supposed to be singing. There's supposed to be joy. So maybe it's something that the Litvisha world had lost a little bit. Maybe they were a little suspicious about, because if you only have the rina and you only have the spiritual fervor without the intensity of the Torah learning, so then you can stray in all kinds of dangerous directions. I think we've seen this because some of the early promoters of Neo-Hasidus really were people who came from the non-Orthodox camp. They came from, the modern Buber camp. They came from the Abraham Joshua Heschel camp. They came from Zalman Schechter Shaloni. They came from people who were not necessarily always mainstream, shall we say, in terms of their Torah ideologies or their Torah teachings or their Torah practices. So there's reason to be suspicious. I always turn to a Gemara in Chulin, Davov, that talks about how at a various point in time, Chazal distanced themselves from the Kutim. The Kutim were always a suspicious sect. They had been converted to Judaism under questionable circumstances. And there was always the question to what degree they could be relied upon or that they could be integrated fully within the Jewish community. And Rabbi Meir wanted to say we should treat them like goyim, and therefore we can't drink their wine and certainly not drink wine with them. Rabbi Gamliel, had similarly wanted to say we can't trust their shechita. And finally, Rabbi Meir got a great tip. Rabbi Meir found that there was a demus yona b'hagrizim, that there was an image of a dove, a sculpted dove, that was placed on Hagrizim, where some of the Kutim lived, and they were bowing down to the dove. So he said, that's it. This is proof that we can't rely upon the Kutim anymore. But nobody paid attention to Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was always worried about minorities. So he was worried there was a minority of the population, of the Kuti population, that did that. But he felt that's sufficient to distance ourselves from them, because from a minority could come a majority, and you can never be too careful. But nobody really listened at that time. But then in the days of Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, says the Gemara, then lo zozu mishama she'asum goyim gemurim. They decided that they're going from henceforth to treat the entire Kuti population like they're completely non-Jewish. What happened? There was a person who came into a town where there were Kutim, and he was told by one of the Hahu Saba, one of the rabbis, one of the old men of the town, said, Amalei leis kan shomrei Torah. Said, these Kutim, they're not observing Torah anymore. So at the point in time in which their practices, their divergences, their deviations led to them not observing Torah anymore. So that's when Asum Ovdei Kochavim Gemurim. That's when they made them into the full-fledged non-Jews. And Rashi says, originally, they didn't want to be Poresh Minakutim, L'Ratzu L'Kaba Oleim Lifosh Minakutim L'Fisha Yuregilim Bohem. Because these people intermingled with them. They went to the same Shachris Minyanim as them. They said Brachos with them. They said Berachos HaMazon with them. They went to, they learned Torah with them. They observed Yontiv with them. They had they bought the same kosher food that they ate. They subscribed to the same Shulchan Aruch that they subscribed to. So yeah, they had slightly different practices. Some of them were a little bit strange. Some of them were off their rocker. But nonetheless, they were still part of the community. But at a point in time in which the practices lead the people not to be Shomrei Torah anymore. Okay, you're wearing a funny yarmulke and you have long payas. Fine, good, I don't care. But you're wearing a funny yarmulke and you have long payas and you're playing a guitar on Shabbos, so then you're outside of the community. Then you're outside of the pale. So to me, that's always the litmus test. Is it Iskan Shomrei Torah or is it Leiskan Shomrei Torah? If it's Iskan Shomrei Torah, people go to the Kalbach Minyanim, that gives them a dose of spiritual fervor, but they're learning Torah, they're observing Torah, they're observing mitzvos, it's all fine and good. At the point in time which that doesn't happen, that's when it's not fine and good.
And just maybe building on that point, there's a variety of ways in which the Neo-Hasidic movement has gone mainstream, meaning there's a whole bunch of different Minyanim that are part of that movement that exist. There's the Stolel in Bergenfield, there's a new minyan in Teaneck, there's of course Esh Kodesh in the Five Towns, loosely connected groups like the University of Purim, other groups, in many, many different teachers of Torah who have a wide influence between Moshe Weinberger and the Weinberg family and the Rosenfeld family really having more and more of an influence, and also a turn to Israeli figures such as Rav Dov Zinger and also Rav Shagar and even Rav Fruman, who have both passed. But people bring in more and more of these thinkers, and in a sense it's becoming part of the fixture of Jewish life without the moves of the early Neo-Hasidic trends which had more of an antinomian aspect to them. And interestingly, actually, I haven't found anyone who's argued that there's really a connection, a direct connection between the early, more antinomian Neo-Hasidic movements of the early 20th century and the movement in America the last two decades. They sort of skip the generation. Some people will read it, but it's not like your average Neo-Hasidic individual is drawing upon them. So it seems like it's really a separate movement, and one that it seems to be is on your standards at least would be very much on board as staying within the Mesorah. I don't know, Risa, do you have any final thoughts on any or all of these topics?
Well, I think that, Neo-Hasidus is also helpful in terms of, the Baal Tshuva movement. There's a lot of question, today as to the efficaciousness of the Baal Tshuva, movement nowadays. How many people have really stayed on board? We see a lot, in terms of the Chabad community being at the forefront of really going out to the towns in the wilderness and in the boondocks and trying to be Makari for Jews, bring people who are outside of the fold back into Judaism. And they've been very successful at attracting individuals to at least come to their events, come to an occasional minyan. But to what degree are people becoming, fully observant? If they become observant, are they staying fully observant? How many people are just going to Minyanim and still driving their cars there every single Shabbos, and doing so in a non-judgmental atmosphere where you don't, on the one hand, the non-judgmental atmosphere brings them in. On the other hand, the non-judgmental atmosphere doesn't spur them necessarily as much to grow. And there's the question as to what's going to be the future of the Baal Tshuva movement. But we've been facing sort of the opposite, phenomenon in recent years, which is the Chozer B'Shaila, movement. those who start out as observant, but then they feel they're not able to keep it up. So in a way, this has become maybe our new focus in terms of the Baal Tshuva movement, namely keeping the people who are already in the fold feel like they still belong. And one of the problems with the classical Litvisha approach is that a lot of it is fire and brimstone and guilt. That doesn't always work for somebody who strays a little bit because lo nitna tova l'malachei asharis, people are not perfect, especially when you live in a very imperfect society. So it's difficult for people to always be on the straight path all the time. And if a person knows that they're not quite as perfect as, you know, the role models that they've been taught to live up to, so it could lead to a certain depression, a certain despondency. And one of the great attractions of Neo-Hasidus is that it says it's okay if you sometimes slipped, it's all right. We're not going to view that as an ideal. We still think that the appropriate state for you to reach is one of full-fledged Shmiras Torah mitzvos. But nonetheless, when you fall, we're still going to embrace you. We're going to reinterpret all of the challenges and roadblocks and difficulties that you've encountered. It's why some of the Hasidic thinkers are very helpful and useful in that regard, like the Apter Rebbe, you know, who always found a way to derive the lesson of the Apter L'Reicha Kamocha in every parsha. And they asked him, oh, where do you find it in Parsha's Balak? And he says, what do you mean, Balak? Beis Lamed Kuf, the Apter L'Reicha Kamocha. And they said, but the base doesn't correspond to above, and the chof doesn't correspond to, you know, either to the kuf. So he said, if you're going to be so nitpicky, then you'll never be able to fulfill the mitzvah after the Reicha Kamocha. So that itself is a lesson. Or the Ishbitzer Rebbe, who basically, you know, is, I would say, almost a savior, you know, for people who have fallen off at the rocker a little bit. Because what the Ishbitzer stands for is the notion that if you've sinned, if you've fallen, so it's all part of a divine plan that these things were supposed to have happened to you so that you can learn from your mistakes in order to reach your full potential. This resonates in a way that captures individuals who otherwise would have become discouraged and despondent from remaining within the fold. So in that sense, I feel that Neo-Hasidus really serves an extremely important purpose as being sort of like the new form of our contemporary Baal Tshuva movement of keeping people within the fold.
So I think maybe we'll close with those inspirational Hasidish messages from Rabbi Reis. Although maybe we'll take a question or two before we go.
Okay. Rabbi Zuki, you mentioned that there are no real successful examples of distance learning or digital learning in Yeshiva Katanas.
No large-scale successes.
Now, I think sociologists of Orthodoxy agree that the greatest challenge for Orthodoxy is day school tuition, holding down family sizes, you know. And so isn't it imperative for the future of modern Orthodoxy that some solution be found in this area? Because, you
know. So, I mean, there are, I think, often the schools that are aiming at implementing technology do have a different tuition scale, and they've been successful in that, although there may be some costs or some drawbacks. But yeah, I think partially what's driving the push towards technology is not just its own merits, but also the question of savings on teacher costs and the like. There's more to be said about the tuition crisis, but maybe that's part of it for a different conversation.
The funny thing about the Gemara is that more people are learning Gemara than ever before, ever since, you know, the whole Daf Yomi and Siyum HaShas craze. So now you have, you know, a 17-year-old girl who just made a Siyum HaShas, and I was eating in a local restaurant with my wife a month ago, right after the Siyum Mashas, and one of her students, she teaches at Hillel Torah in Skokie, Illinois, so one of her seventh grade girls was there with her mother, and the mother very proudly said, my daughter started learning Daf Yomi because she was so inspired. So everyone's Kimala Aretz, Deyar Hashem, Kamayim Liyam Nechasim. There were so many different study aids that the learning of Gemara has become easier than ever. Had you asked me that question, 30 years ago, I would have said, yeah, maybe Gemara's not for everybody, but you can't deny Gemara from anyone. Everyone wants to learn. I went on a Federation trip a couple of weeks ago to Venice with a number of the rabbis in the Chicago area. These include Orthodox rabbis, non-Orthodox rabbis. In Chicago, we can get away with things you can't get away with here. And and I was asking one of the female Orthodox rabbis who was on this trip, trying to find some common ground for conversation. It's a very nice opportunity to be able to find a greater sense of achdus amongst the Jewish people and to raise everyone's level of observance, because what I try to do is to show that the services we offer at the Chicago Rabbinical Council are not only for members of the Orthodox community, but for the broader community. You have a din Torah, you have a get, so it's appropriate to come to us. You can feel comfortable with us. That's an important message. But I asked her, I said, with all of the hoopla around the Siyum Mashas, has anybody in your own community started learning Gemara? And she said, yeah, everyone's really excited about it. And my own son, he started learning Daf Yomi. And you have all of these resources available online. And it's impossible if you have Jewish people sitting and learning Daf Yomi, sitting and learning Gemara. So there's no way that that's not going to have a positive religious effect on them. So I think, we should not undermine the ability of Chedo Kobes Yisrael to be able to learn Gemara.
And maybe I'll just add to that, that there are some, I think the Neo-Hasidic trend does show that there at least are some people who, whether they, whether they have those resources or not, that's not where they're drawn. That's not where they're focusing their energies, and they, they'd rather go in other directions. So it's a good question. I mean, we, I guess maybe this is the grand experiment. We'll see.
Okay. Thank you very much.